Welcome to The Read-Along,
a mini book club for your ears.
I'm your host, Scott.
I'm your other host, Anita.
And join us on a journey through a good book,
one chapter at a time.
Do you like talking about movies? Do you like talking about mediocre movies? Do you like talking about how you could have fixed mediocre movies? Well, I certainly do, and you can listen to me, Scott C. Bourgeois, along with my co-hosts Greg Beaver and Liam Creswick, as we give our notes, and I have some notes. You can follow it now on your podcatcher of choice or support it by visiting patreon.com/ihavesomenotes. In the process of dealing with like clothing transitions with both of our kids.
Small children, they grow fast.
Yeah, not just in the sense that we need to get them more clothes because they are growing, but also, first of all, our daughter has taken great delight in starting to dress herself and has no fashion sense whatsoever.
She's four.
Yes, but we've been discussing ways to try to like encourage her to learn to match her clothes a little better. So that's an endeavor that's begun. Meanwhile, our son has decided that it is now officially basically summertime, and it's time for shorts. And we had to talk him down to wearing pants today because it's supposed to be quite cool and windy at the time of recording.
Yes.
And that actually took a little bit of effort because he was just like, but it's nice out.
It's interesting because it seems to me that both of our children have just been chomping at the bit to get back into summer clothes.
Yeah.
Like, the number of times I've had to talk our daughter down from just a dress,
a light summer dress. Yeah.
Like, there's still snow on the ground, honey. No, no, no.
Yeah. Or wearing her sandals out.
Oh, my gosh. She wants into her sandals so badly.
When it's cool and there's still, like, crunchy snow on the ground. Also, when I dropped our son off at school today, I dropped him off. The bell had just rung and I was leaving. I heard his teacher say, oh, it's good to see that you're all not wearing your shorts today. So he's definitely not the only one of the kids who's been like just jumped right into shorts as soon as the sun started shining and the snow was gone.
Must be a kid thing, like a spring detector.
They're ready to go. They're ready to have fun.
There's sunshine. Please let us outside.
So that's the adventures that have been going on in our place for the last little bit.
Also, as we have all gotten sick in sequence, I am the last.
Yeah.
And I am recovering.
Yeah. So if there are occasional pauses or breaks in the recording, it's because I have been editing out Anita's coughing and hacking.
Horrible hacking cough. And if I sound a little rough, that's why. I'm recovering from a death cold, and I am currently medicated.
There you go. But we do want to record.
Yes, of course.
You're not so sick that we can't talk about a book.
No, there is story to talk about here.
Indeed. So we should get into it, starting with a brief recap of chapter 16 of our novel, in which Cornelia brings over Beckett to defend himself from their suspicions, and he succeeds only in putting both of his feet firmly in his mouth by insulting everyone and sundry.
Yeah.
With his really tactless conversational approach. But we do learn a little bit more about him, and we do get a potential alibi for the 2nd of October. And then Mallory, after a brief nap, accidentally commits coleoptericide, something that she is still feeling guilty about as we move into chapter 17 of The Undetectables by Courtney Smith. Chapter 17 begins fairly early in the morning with about 5 days left to Samhain, and Mallory feels like crap, not just because the pain, the general pain of existing, but also because she is weighted down by guilt over what she did the night before.
Yeah, and it doesn't help that they have not had enough sleep. They are up incredibly early today.
Because there's a funeral to attend.
Yes.
And they want to be there for that funeral.
And the funeral happens at dawn.
Yes.
So they are up very early.
Not so early that a little bit of conversation can't happen first, though. Cornelia and Diana are already up and chatting, and Cornelia is trying to avoid talking to Diana about Beckett until Mallory gets there by trying to convince her to put deadly spiders in her room.
This feels like a bad tactic.
Cornelia's fondest love is insects. So, of course, she's going to use that as her smokescreen.
It's funny to me, though, that to her this seemed like a good idea.
And Diana is vehemently against it.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, I love bugs, so everyone obviously loves bugs. And clearly I can talk my best friend into keeping these terrifying to her bugs in her room.
Yeah, and Diana wants nothing to do with it.
I know.
And I think...
The nerds in the crowd will be like, spiders aren't bugs. I know they're not. But to Diana, I bet they are.
Cornelia also doesn't appear to have noticed any problems with her beetle collection yet today.
Yet.
And Mallory, several times through the beginning of this chapter, walks up to confessing because of how guilty she feels, but just can't bring herself to say, oh, I accidentally murdered one of your bugs last night, and it caused a whole problem.
Yeah, she... It's not like there's ever a good time to tell someone that you've kind of done something terrible. And it obviously isn't going to come up organically.
No.
Until Cornelia notices.
Yeah.
And so Mallory just sort of lies by omission.
But the good news is Cornelia pivots the conversation very quickly to, hey, so about Beckett.
Okay. So on the one hand, Cornelia is finally doing the thing we talked about last time.
Yeah.
Where she is actually trying to explain to her friends what she sees in this guy.
Yes.
And I marvel that it took so long, but I'm glad that it happened.
I think maybe Cornelia was hoping that Beckett would account for himself well the day before. And
he did not.
Recognizes that that did not happen. And so now she's taking the time to actually finally explain things. She starts out by explaining how they ended up together. And the key thing is that they both felt like outsiders at university. They found each other because they were both on the outside of the crowd.
Yeah.
Cornelia went to an apparent university. When she was quickly identified as both rich and a witch, she found herself kind of on the outs.
Ostracized isn't the right word.
No, but...
For it, but I maybe think that's how she felt.
Yeah, and I don't think she was necessarily being ostracized either so much as she found it difficult to make friends because the people who were there didn't really have much in common with her.
Yes.
Because she was both magic and filthy, filthy rich.
Yes. Awkward for everybody.
Yeah, and that kind of allowed her to fall into the orbit of Beckett, who was also an outsider, as a vampire.
Yep.
On the fringes of apparent culture, where he also feels like an outsider. The two of them naturally gravitated towards one another because they had that little bit of common ground. And in finding kindred spirits, they became close and kind of intimate with one another because they could share with one another in a way they couldn't with anybody else. And because of that, Beckett opened up to her. And she sees the, from her perspective at least, kind soul inside of him. And she's maybe a little more forgiving of his foot-in-mouth disease than others are because of that. And that's kind of what she's trying to impart here to her friends. And she's like, yes, I get it. He can be abrasive. He can be tactless. He's not good with people. But when you get to know him the way I have, you can see he's kind of a sweetheart.
And that's all well and good for Cornelia.
Yes.
But Diana and Mallory just don't see it.
No.
They cannot see through that outer shell of like horrible, tactless person.
Yeah.
My guess is because it's real thick.
Yeah. And I mean, Cornelia's like, look, I explained everything to him last night as well. I explained the situation with Mallory, which I clearly hadn't done beforehand. And he is sorry. He is sorry for all of the stuff. And I'm apologizing on his behalf because, of course, he'll just mess it up.
Also, he's not here anymore.
And he's gone home, yes. So that's kind of where they're at. Mallory's willing to kind of like... accept Cornelia's apology here. Diana, less so. A fight almost starts again.
Yeah.
But Mallory shuts that down by being like, hey, so would you be able to check on his alibi for October 2nd? And Cornelia's like, I can try, but the location they went to is pretty remote. There's not really cell service out there. And to the best of my knowledge, his cousin is still there. So it might be hard to get in touch with him right away. And Diana's like, well, isn't that convenient?
Yeah. Yeah, the whole thing's a little awkward and a little rough.
Everything with Beckett is awkward and rough.
Right? Exactly. But we have a funeral to get to.
Yes. And that takes up much of the rest of the chapter as the girls head to the fairy funeral for Ben, where pretty much all of the movers and shakers in town have shown up.
It's a well-attended event.
Yeah.
Let's say.
It's made pretty clear, like, Ben is amongst the affluent members of...
At least the fairy community.
The fairy community,
for sure.
Yeah. And so, like, he was well-connected. People, if they didn't know him personally, knew his family.
Yeah.
It's like if Cornelia had died. Like, everyone would show up. Even if they didn't know her personally, they probably know her folks.
Know of her, at least, right? Yeah. I imagine it's the same with Ben. Like, those that knew him loved him a lot.
Yeah.
Like, it's very obvious, because this was a very emotional event. And so many people show up that he was clearly, like, well-known.
The good news is that means that both the Nightmare and Grey Quinn are in attendance.
Yeah.
Beckett naturally doesn't show up. He's not well-connected. And Detective Inspector O'Sullivan isn't there.
No.
But Grey Quinn and the Nightmare, as movers and shakers in the community, are there. And, of course, the Nightmare is there with his assistant, Jacob.
Mm-hmm. Who you are suspecting more and more every chapter.
Yeah, whose presence is noted and is conspicuously wearing gloves for some reason.
Mm. Maybe it's just because it's a formal event.
No, we're just going to put a pin in that. We're going to come right back to it.
Yeah, right.
Don't you worry.
Mallory's in almost an awkward position here because she met Ben twice, ever.
Yeah.
Right?
But she's friends with his friends.
Yes, exactly. So she is there to mourn. Yes, it is a funeral of someone she met and knew and who, through connections, she would have known more.
She's almost there more to support the people she knows who are mourning for him.
Right?
Than to mourn him directly.
But this means that she is now the one who has also been tasked with actually working the case at the funeral, which is a little weird.
Yeah.
I think, especially for her.
The good news is she gets a wingman right away because Diana decides...
They have, like, clamps to her side. And...
Yeah, and decides to spend the funeral with her. And I think that that might be part of Diana's, like, coping mechanism at the funeral.
Maybe.
She'd rather... like, be distracted and be with her friend than be focused on her grief. And so the two of them end up working the funeral together. They keep an eye especially on Grey Quinn, because this is the first opportunity they've really had to talk to him since the murders.
It's true.
Started. And they single him out after the main thrust of the event is done. And people have started to, like, go to the luncheon or whatever. They manage to corner him briefly and have a conversation with him.
And for once, Diana tells some very good lies.
I mean, as previously established, she is very good at telling lies until she's not.
Yeah, until she's not. And I think having Mallory beside her found that cutoff.
Yeah, Mallory basically, like, approaches him and then can't act, like, he's so devastatingly handsome and demonically charming that she can't, like, formulate words. And Grey Quinn is just like, may I help you? And when nothing comes out, he's like, well, this was awkward. Good day.
Good day. And then Diana steps in with her... fabulous, mostly lie.
Yeah, where she's like, oh, sorry, I'm the daughter of a famous fashion designer, giving us a little more background on Diana.
Yes.
And explains why she's interested in, like, the arts and theater.
Obviously, she's telling the truth because Quinn, like, corroborates her information.
Yeah, like,
right?
Immediately clocks her, like, oh, you're part of that.
Oh, yes, I know
family.
That name and I know this about, oh, yes, okay, so...
And she comes up with a plausible lie of, like, look, my mom's really famous and connected. I'm trying to, like, follow in the footsteps there and make my own fortune. And I know you're a hotelier.
Good word, hotelier.
And I know that you host, like, big events at your hotels and stuff. The Quinn hotels are very famous. Would you be able to hook me up? She soft pedals this by asking him about his outfit at first.
Of course.
But playing on his vanity a little bit. And Grey Quinn is like, okay, yeah, I might be able to help you out with that. She passes off Mallory as her, like, accountant.
Yeah. Well, to be fair, Mallory's just sort of standing there dumbfounded because she doesn't know what to say.
Yeah. And Grey Quinn is like, I might be able to help you out. And she uses this as a segue to be like, I heard there was an event at one of your hotels on October 2nd. What can you tell me about it? Trying to get an alibi out of him. And he corroborates there was an event. He was there and the Nightmare was there.
Mm-hmm.
So both of them potentially have an October 2nd alibi.
Yep.
Quinn seems to intimate that he was there the whole time, hobnobbing with people, and he could be accounted for in that way. But the Nightmare was up and down quite a few times, apparently.
Yeah.
And may have disappeared for a little while. Hard to say.
Here's the thing, though. You're talking about a political position that requires someone to be... quite busy.
Yes.
So him being up and down and in and out of an event isn't necessarily suspicious.
I mean, he leaves the funeral very quickly after giving a very kind of awkward and running up to borderline offensive speech.
Like, right to the edge. And I think for some people, stepped over that line.
Yeah. And makes his way out shortly thereafter.
Yeah, like wormed a bid for re-election into his funeral speech. Like, dude, read the room.
Yeah, so, I mean, him being up and down and preoccupied during the event at the hotel on the 2nd, suspicious, but not necessarily murderously so.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. He was in attendance with his young trophy wife as well.
Mm-hmm.
Gray Quinn mentions not to his tastes, but we already knew he was gay because he was flirting with Theodore at the beginning.
Yes.
So... Diana also takes this opportunity to steal his pocket square so that they have a DNA sample from him.
Assuming that there is some DNA on that pocket square, yes.
Indeed. And I think he catches her.
You think?
Mallory mentions that after he's like, women aren't really to my taste, and Diana's like, I am exactly the opposite, that there's like a moment that passes between them. And then he's like, well, it was nice meeting you. I'm going to make you real rich. And Diana later mentions, for half a second while I was magicking away his pocket square, I thought he was going to bite my head off. And I think it was that moment. I think he caught her doing it, but didn't call her on it. And I wonder if there was like a moment where he's like, that was audacious and I kind of respect it.
He doesn't know why she took it.
Like, no.
For all he knows, she's, you know, like a weird fangirl who just wants a piece of him.
It's very possible. Or he might like clock that he's being grilled in this moment and be like, well, if this will help corroborate my story or something.
Maybe.
And make it clear that I'm not a suspect. It's hard to tell what was going through his brain in that moment, but I read that as he clocked her doing it, but decided not to catch her on it.
But let it happen anyway?
But let it happen.
Interesting.
For whatever reason.
I don't know. We don't know enough about Gray Quinn as a character. Like, I just don't feel like we've had enough exposure to him.
He's been very much lurking kind of in the background.
Very much so.
Yeah. So, interesting to see where that goes or how that develops. And I could be misreading that situation, but I clocked that as he knows that she did the thing. She knows he knows that she did the thing. And he just kind of let it happen anyway.
Mm-hmm. Don't know. Maybe. Yeah. We'll see.
Hard to say.
We'll see.
They try to find Van Doren after that, but can't corner him before he's gone.
Yeah, he's already taken off.
And that's more or less where the action of the chapter kind of wraps up.
Yes.
But there is some other, like, interesting stuff to note in the chapter. And that's where I want to kind of come back to Jacob.
Oh, yes. Shall we pull that pin now?
Yeah. So he's there, noticeably, with the nightmare, which doesn't surprise me because he is the nightmare's assistant.
Yeah.
But it's once again the story drawing attention to him.
Mm-hmm.
He waves at them.
Yeah.
Like he sees them come
in. He's like, hello. And like an enthusiastic wave at them.
Like a very familiar wave to them. And for a guy who's only kind of like...
Met them once or twice?
Met them a few times and been kind of tangentially involved. He greets them like he knows them a little more familiarly than that.
Mm-hmm.
As I mentioned, he's also conspicuously wearing gloves.
Why is that conspicuous?
It's conspicuous to me because no one else wearing gloves is mentioned. Like, it's not like this is a thing with fairies or anything. It's just he's wearing gloves for some reason.
Mm.
Previously... we noticed a cut on his hand. It was pointed out that he had a scabbed over cut on his hand. That's why Theodore offered him the bandage.
Right.
When he came to visit and say, I can't help you with your investigation anymore.
Right.
Because I suspect they're investigating him. And I had supposed that maybe wielding the deadly knife of deadly death has some inherent risk to it. And
maybe.
A second murder has now taken place and Jacob is suddenly wearing gloves, maybe to hide a subsequent knife injury.
Maybe.
Just pointing it out.
Just, yeah, I know.
And then he is openly weeping about Ben, a person we don't think he knows personally, to the best of our knowledge, after the eulogy and after the event has wrapped up. He's clearly been bawling. And we've previously supposed that these murders are motivated by a feeling of necessity. By someone who doesn't mean harm to these people, but feels it is necessary to harm these people.
I don't want to kill you, but you need to die.
And that could... result in someone feeling tremendous guilt and a great deal of sadness having attended the funeral for one of his victims.
Yes.
This is a mountain of circumstantial
evidence. Absolutely is.
I can see where you're going with it.
And you can see it on my face. I know you can't see my face on the podcast, but there was a face. You're filling in a lot of blanks here. But so far in our novel, there has been nothing to disprove what you've said.
Yeah.
Right? I can't poke that many holes in your theory. And I do think it's a strong theory. But I do have to acknowledge that you are filling in a lot of blanks on your own.
Yeah.
So, like, we might be very wrong. I genuinely, at this point, think you're right, but we can't prove it.
I've made a very convincing argument
for Jacob. You really
have. Here's the other thing. Because, again, looking back in the novel is perfectly fair game.
Of course it is.
We don't read ahead. We do one chapter at a time. But we can look back. And I went back to look at some of the information about Custer's death. What was he doing October 2nd before he was murdered? Working at the mayor's office.
Yes.
He was working in data entry, cataloging the inventory at the mayor's office, at the nightmare's office.
Yeah, things that are kept in the mayoral office.
What if the deadly knife of deadly death was being kept there? It is an important relic.
Yep.
There's no reason to suggest it might not have been in the inventory at the nightmare's office. He might have accidentally brought it to Jacob's attention.
It's true. Custer might have accidentally started this whole thing.
And in doing so, also because he could then identify the only person I told about it was Jacob, Jacob makes him his first victim.
Plausible. 100% plausible. We have no proof.
We have absolutely no proof, but it is plausible.
Yep. It is a sound hypothesis.
And again, apparents can use magic items.
Yes.
We have evidence of that in the story. There's no reason that a magically imbued knife of deadly death couldn't be used by Jacob to commit occult murders.
Correct.
And again, he'd be completely below suspicion because he's an apparent. He can't use magic himself.
Maybe. I've been giving it to you this whole time. A solid maybe.
I'm side-eyeing the accusing parlor door. I'm just saying. I'm giving it side-eye. I don't have definitive proof, but I'm walking up real close to making a formal accusation.
Against Jacob.
Against Jacob as the murderer.
I mean, we're only, halfway?
Yeah.
About halfway.
Still plenty of book to go. And I mean, Gray Quinn and the Nightmare are definitely up to something shady.
Oh, clearly. I don't know if it's murder, but it's definitely shady.
I don't think it's murder, but it's definitely shady. They're keeping secrets, and it's making them look suspicious. Detective Inspector O'Sullivan has a chip on her shoulder. That's making her look suspicious. And Beckett's just, I think, a harmless idiot. A harmless idiot who can't help but make himself look suspicious.
Yeah. It's also possible that Beckett is a rube. I haven't given that one up yet.
Or that Cornelia is his rube and he is up to something suspicious, but ultimately benign in the sense that it has nothing to do with murder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe. I hope.
Because you suggested that he and Cornelia might share a disdain for authority and that
yes.
there might be some sort of anti-establishment business going on here.
It's possible that they are both the rubes.
That they're rubing each other.
Gross. I have one more little thing. I just want to give props to Courtney Smith specifically as our author. At the very end of the chapter, Mallory makes this lovely comment about how they take the next hour and just put the case aside and just leave space to mourn Ben. And I found that to be very impactful. I liked that a lot. It felt right.
Yeah.
It showed compassion on Mallory's side mm-hmm. For her friends, for her now lost new friend. It meant something.
Yeah.
I just wanted to give that props.
Well, that said, I think this episode may have dragged on a little longer than we intended. We went into this being like, oh, this is going to be a pretty short recording. And we're...
Turns out we had a lot to say.
So we'll put an end to it here and wrap it up. So you'll want to read up on chapter 18 in time for next week. And in the meantime, of course, you can always give us a little rating and a review.
We do appreciate those.
Yeah. You can also reach out to us on social media.
Absolutely. We are on X, Instagram, Facebook, Blue Sky, and Goodreads. We are at The Read Along on any of those that need an at.
Yes. You can also send us an email.
Oh, please do. We are thereadalong@gmail.com.
And with that said, as always, we love you very much, and we'll see you next time.
Sam Haynes a-coming.
Thank you for joining us on The Read Along with your hosts, Anita and Scott Bourgeois. All Read Along music is by Kevin MacLeod at Incompetech.com. Cover art is by Aaron Beaver. Be sure to join us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at The Read Along, and check out our group on Goodreads.com.